The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining me this morning. Now, I'm about to talk about Chevron deference. And my Steeler fans' friends think that means there's a line at the gas station like under Jimmy Carter. That's not what it is. But you need to understand Chevron deference and to understand why a new court filing in Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo may finally lead to what we need in this country, which is a checking in of the administrative state. It's been filed by the former Solicitor General of the United States, Paul Clement, who joins me now. General Clement, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Great to talk to you.
It's great to be with you. I'm very happy to talk about the case.
You are a friend of Carol Platt Liebau, and she's been telling me for years, how can you not know Paul Clement? You know Ruxley, you know Ted Olson, you knew Chuck Cooper, and you know Ken Starr. I just never run across him. He's too young. So am I correct you've argued more than 100 Supreme Court's arguments thus far?
That's right, Hugh. I have argued more than 100 cases. Quite amazing to me.
That is so fabulous. And I have personally recommended this man to people when they are looking for Supreme Court litigators, because you don't want to send in local counsel, actually, to argue before the Supreme Court. This case of Loper Bright, though, caught my eye, Paul Clement, because I teach con law and I try and explain Chevron deference. And even law students' eyes glaze over. But it can't be an issue for the administrative conference. It can't be an issue for administrative lawyers and professors. It matters to every small business in America carrying great burdens of regulation. Will you explain what Chevron deference is and then what Loper Bright is going to try and do?
I would be delighted to. So the thing about Chevron, at least that makes me so kind of concerned about it, is if you and I have a lawsuit and we disagree about the meaning of a statute, the court is ultimately going to have to figure out which one of us is right, and there's no tiebreaker. They have to do all the work, and they have to get to a point where they just give their best impression as to what the statute means. But if instead of having a legal dispute with you, I have a legal dispute with a federal government agency, then instead of the courts having to get the statute just right and figure out what's the best reading of the statute, they essentially get to look at it, and unless the statute is clearly in my favor, then basically the courts will defer to the government. And that's really never made any sense to me. I mean, in a system where we're trying to protect the liberty of the individuals, you would think that the rule is, if the statute's unclear, the tie ought to go to the citizen, not that the tie ought to go to the government. But
Amen.
The rule is unfortunately the opposite.
In 1983,
and 84. And we are trying to change that case.
And we're going to talk about the plaintiffs especially, but I was going to say in 1983 to 84, when I clerked on the D.C. Circuit, it's before Chevron. And we had different tests. I mean, it was a mess, and no one quite knew what to do with it. But this Chevron deference came in after I stopped actually practicing, other than as an administrative lawyer looking for permits. It's completely changed the way that the government operates, and I don't know that. Do you think the justices understand how absolutely indifferent agencies are to the average person approaching them for help?
I think some of the justices do. I think that is really one of the things that the change in personnel on the court over the last couple of years has really made a big difference, because I do think that Justice Kavanaugh saw this firsthand on the D.C. Circuit. Even though Justice Gorsuch was out in Denver, administrative law was a particular focus of his. So he understands these issues. He understands the stakes. And I think they have an appreciation that the Chevron doctrine is problematic, both from the standpoint of the citizen facing the government in a particular case. But I think they also appreciate that it really kind of erodes the way the separation of powers is supposed to work in our system of government, because it makes it, frankly, too easy for the executive branch to legislate. And when you allow the executive branch to legislate, it makes it easier for Congress not to legislate and to just sit on the sidelines and let the executive branch try to deal with some of the big issues in society. And, you know, it's hard enough to call your congressperson and get their attention, but try getting a hold of some regulator at the National Marine Fisheries Service or the Environmental Protection Agency or fill in the blank. And, you know, they're not responsive, and they're not responsive for a reason that I think the framers of our Constitution would well understand. Why would they be responsive? They don't have to face the electorate. You know, the genius of the framers was they put most of the power and all of the power to legislate in the hands of people that were going to face the electorate, at least in the House of Representatives, and in the Senate, they were going to be responsive to the states. So the idea that the people who would pass laws that would tell you when you should fish and, you know, when you can pay for some government monitor to be stuck on your boat, which starts to get into the facts of our case, they assumed that those restrictions on our liberty would only be imposed by people we could pretty immediately vote out of office.
You know, it's the closest thing to a Third Amendment case I've ever seen. But I got to tell you, last night I was trying to explain to my wife, who's been listening to me complain about the Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 30 years. I'm retired now, so I have no active cases, nothing, no conflict. But for 30 years, she heard me complain. She could not believe the facts that I gave her about Loper Bright. So would you please tell our audience the facts, because no one's going to believe it.
I would be delighted to. So the first fact, which is really bad enough and already is so bad that it did cause me to cite the Third Amendment to our Constitution in our reply brief. And I've been at this a long time, and I'm not sure I've gotten a chance to cite our Third Amendment.
First time I've ever seen it.
The law itself does give the federal government the ability to force fishing vessels to essentially have a monitor who's a federal government's eyes and ears on their boat. And it is an incredible imposition when you understand that we're not talking about massive commercial boats with enough space for 20 or 30 fishermen. We're talking about relatively small fishing vessels that have enough room for 5, 6, 7, 8 people. And the idea that one of those 5, 6, 7, 8 people is going to be a government agent who's not going to do any fishing themselves and is just going to be there making sure that you're not taking too much of one kind of fish or another, that's bad enough. But that's not really what the case is about. What the case is really about is that without any authority from Congress, the agency has said, not only do you have to have this monitor on board, but you have to pay their salary. You have to foot the bill for having somebody whose full-time job is to take space on your boat and to make sure you're obeying the law.
Up to 20% of your catch, right? Up to 20% of your profits, you have to pay the government.
Absolutely, you have to pay for this monitor. And there are one or two places where the law does require a contribution from the vessel owner to pay for the monitor, but it's only for one or two situations. It's only with respect to larger commercial fisheries who can essentially afford it. But here's the kicker. The one or two places that Congress has authorized it, they limit the amount of the imposition to 2 or 3%. So here the agency gives itself the power, but then it doesn't put really any limit on it. And here it can be up to 20% of their profits go poof.
Yeah, you know, General Clement, when I read the D.C. Circuit's opinion, which is a 2-1 opinion, I read that after I read your petition for cert before I wrote my Washington Post column. They seem to treat the Supreme Court new precedent on administrative law the way that the National Marine Fisheries Service treated the comment. It was like a Potemkin Village notice and comment here. 90% of the notice and comment responses said, don't do this, you'll kill us. And the National Marine Fisheries Service just dismissed them. Well, the D.C. Circuit took a look at what the Supreme Court's been saying about administrative law, and they said, we are fully aware of that, but this isn't that. And I said, oh, my gosh, this is exactly that. I mean, isn't that your reaction? This is exactly what the major questions doctrine or other changes. Maybe they just need a 2x4 to get it right.
Well, sometimes the court has to give an unmistakable message to the courts of appeals before they'll listen. You know, I had a case last term, completely different area of the law. But for years and years and years, the Supreme Court had basically been saying, we've moved away from our Lemon test in the Establishment Clause context. And last term, the court got frustrated with lower courts not getting the message and just made it unmistakably clear in the case involving Coach Kennedy. And I think we may need something else in the administrative law area.
Let's go there, because I think you're right. I got 30 years of experience with Rapanos. All right, Rapanos isn't 30 years old, but I did ACOE permitting for all those years. Rapanos comes down, and you don't have to know that, America, what it means, but it's clear direction of the Army Corps of Engineers that they're doing it wrong. And the Army Corps of Engineers proceeded to read Rapanos, Anthony Kennedy's opinion, and say, let's just continue doing what we want to do. It's like this vast kudzu of agencies that don't care about every effort to check them, Paul Clement. What do you want the court, if you could write the opinion for them, what would they say as a rule to replace Chevron?
Well, I would say, personally, the first step is you overrule Chevron, make it unmistakable, and then you just essentially force everybody to do their job. I mean, the courts just have to interpret the statutes. They can't put a thumb on the scale in favor of the government. If they're going to put a thumb on the scale anywhere, it should be on the side of the citizen. But they should just do their job. They should figure out what the statute means. They shouldn't defer to the agency in the process. And then I think the net effect of that will be to have the executive branch do less and have Congress essentially be forced to do more. And I'm sure many of your listeners don't think, you know, Congress doing more sounds like necessarily a great idea. I suppose it depends on the Congress. But I do think our system of government is set up that the only people that should be legislating in Washington, D.C. ought to be the Congress. It shouldn't be people in the executive branch that nobody can get a hold of, nobody can complain, they aren't accountable to the electorate. And Hugh, I'll tell you what really attracted to me to this case. You know, I've had other cases where I've tried to cut back on Chevron, but I've been arguing for, you know, on behalf of, you know, major oil companies, major chemical companies. But this case, more than most, really kind of puts it on the level of the individual citizen, and it kind of puts Chevron in context to what it means to a small business person.
That's why I love it. And anyone who saw the movie Coda, they saw a federal monitor on a fishing boat screwing up the fishing boat, and it's a small business that's barely making ends meet. And I found that in my life, big development, big landowners can deal with the agencies because they can hire me and people like me at ridiculous amounts to deal with a 7-year entitlement. Little landowners get crushed by the EPA. The Chevron deference actually puts the largest burden on the smallest clients.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And sophisticated clients know how to lobby agencies. When they get with the agency, they're not ignored the way that 90% of the commentators here were. And so I do think that Chevron, you know, it seems like, I mean, just the name of the case, you know, you just think big companies, you know, being regulated by the federal government, hard to know who to root for. But in a case like this, where, you know, you see these vessels are really, they are classic small businesses. they are being regulated, some of them virtually out of existence by these burdens. And so this is just really important. I really hope the court will take it. As you know, Hugh, getting the Supreme Court to take any one case is about the hardest thing to do in Washington. But I do think that, you know, we have some great support from amici, you know, friends of the court, but they are urging the court to take this case. We have something like 10 amicus briefs in support of this. We have people like you writing columns highlighting the case, and I thank you for that. I mean, so I think we have a lot going for us, but I really hope the court will take this case.
Well, let me raise the objection that came up in response to the column I wrote in the Washington Post. 1,600 people got angry at me and put nasty comments down. They said, oh, wow, well-timed. The bank just collapsed for lack of regulation and the train just derailed for lack of regulation. And I don't get mad at people. They don't understand. That's got nothing to do with regulatory failure. That's got a lot to do with regulatory capture. And I mean, do you think you're going to run into that argument from our friends on the maybe center left side of the court? Your old, you know, Justice Kagan was Solicitor General Kagan first. Is she going to say, oh, my gosh, you're proposing an unregulated world, Paul Clement?
I don't think so. I mean, look, I'm not saying that if this case gets up there, I will have every justice with me. But I think somebody like Justice Kagan, who has seen the full scope, the way you know, I would obviously had the same job as she did. And when you have a job like that, you see all of the regulatory output of the federal government. And you realize that all these regulations are not committed equal. There are some areas where the regulations work. There are other areas where, as you say, the real problem is regulatory capture, not overregulation. But then there are some areas where it's just the regulatory agencies are unchecked. And of course, we talked about this already, but where would you expect to see that? Would you expect to see Citibank overregulated? No. You'd expect to see people like these small fishing vessels and their operations overregulated because they just don't have the forces to fight back. And again, going back to just like the genius of the framers, you know, they expected small businesses to mostly be regulated by the states and local governments, where a small business still might have a foothold in the community, ability to get the ears of legislatures, get sympathy from other people in the community who the legislatures had to be respectful for. But when you have the federal government directly regulating small businesses, it's just not a fair fight.
Well, now, General Clement, I can just hear Justice Brown Jackson or Justice Sotomayor saying, so you're saying that we should just dismantle the federal administrative process, where that we're just going to turn these people loose. I know you're not saying that, but you're going to need a different rule to come up with, right?
We are going to need a different rule. And the different rule in this context, though, I think is the rule that applies in almost every other area of the law. As we said at the outset, if you and I get in a lawsuit and the lawsuit turns in the meaning of the statute, the court decides the meaning of the statute. One of us is right, one of us is wrong. But one of us doesn't leave court with the court telling us, well, you know, it was close, and we actually think the statute's unclear, and we're just going to go with the government because they're the government. I mean, that just doesn't – I don't think that passes the basic fairness test. So I don't think – you know, this may not be the case. There are going to be other cases down the line, right, where – the court wrestles with whether we can really even have some of these so-called independent agencies that aren't directly accountable to the president and end up being accountable to no one. And in those cases, it may be fair to ask, well, what's that going to mean for regulation? But here, I think in some respects, it's easier, because what's going to happen if the court moves away from Chevron is that courts will have to do their job, agencies will have to do their jobs, and that will, I think, the combined effect of that will force Congress to do its job.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Well, even if they say silence is an ambiguity, I mean, or this is almost ambiguous. It was such a strange D.C. Circuit opinion. I thought this is a wide open door for every petty tyrant in the 2.8 million strong civilian federal employment workforce. And I know that there are a lot of good people trying to do good work, but there's a bell curve in everything. So last question, Paul Clement. How do we get notice and comment rulemaking back to what the APA godfathers thought it would be? A genuinely deliberative process where data mattered. Because I have seen it as a general counsel myself of a federal agency right through to when I laid down the lists and got out of the law. They don't care what you send in. They pretend to read it. They pretend to answer it. And then they do what they would have done 60, 90 days, whatever. And we see that all the time, depending on who's in charge of the agency. How do we fix that? Because it's a Potemkin village notice and comment process.
I agree. And I think that has to be fixed through rigorous enforcement of the APA and kind of meaningful review. But I really do think this case could be a step in the right direction. And just one last thought on this case and why it's so important. I'm a realistic person. I've lived in Washington a long time now, and I always feel like, you know, there are things that the court can do, but one of the other protections we have against overregulation is just, you know, at some point, if an agency puts so many regulations on the books, they can't even pay enough people to enforce them. And that's why I find this case so important and so pernicious, because if the executive branch can essentially fund its own monitors, doesn't need appropriations from Congress, it can just say, look, you the regulated, you the citizens, you have to pay essentially for additional government officials and agents to enforce our laws, then there's almost no practical limit.
Well, that caught my attention. I began to think about in the regulatory context I'm familiar with, what if I have to pay for a monitor from the Army Corps of Engineers to be on the site for every day of the site construction, and I have to pay for it? My developer client has to pay for it. And they can't do that. Or if you're an OSHA-regulated person and OSHA says you're going to have an OSHA inspector there 24/7 and you're going to pay for it, that is an unlimited taxing authority. It can't be constitutional.
It really can't. Because the one thing the framers were absolutely clear about is the power of purse. The power of the purse has to be with Congress, and particularly has to start in the House of Representatives, the most representative branch of government. So I do think the framers would be particularly offended by this particular form of regulation where the regulators are essentially appropriating their own funds and spending it to essentially get additional federal agents monitoring every one of us.
I hope everyone reads your petition for cert in the reply as well. Let me just get close by asking you, when do you expect to hear from the court? Obviously, it hadn't been even scheduled for a conference yet, I don't think. But when would you expect to hear? And then the argument would be next fall, right?
The argument would be next fall. We would expect to hear within the next month. So it is now fully briefed and it's being distributed to the justices. So I think we're 3 or 4 weeks away. And there are obviously some vagaries of timing there, and the court can hold the case and relist it, which it usually does before it grants. So we'll be looking for hopefully some good news in about a month.
Well, you've got three alumni of the D.C. Circuit out of the nine. I think they would be. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh has been waiting for this case for years, I would assume. Good luck in that. And General Clement, thank you for joining me and talking about this case. I hope you'll keep coming back when we get one this big, this important. And people don't even know about it because it's fishing boats, right? They don't get it. But you're doing your best to raise its profile. And I appreciate that you did it with me.
No, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Food for the Poor needs your help. Food for the Poor is our great sponsor. And this is the time of the year that they come out and they say to you, here is the need. Can you give us $10, $100, $150, $200? $72 takes care of two children for an entire year. Water, food, and good food and water. That's it. They're rice and beans and water. That's what Food for the Poor does. And they do it as well as anybody. Here is the president of Food for the Poor talking about what they do and how you matter to them.
We work in 20 countries in the Caribbean and Latin America, and people who have no other resources except the incredible generosity of typically Americans who, you know, time and time again, you know, really just give from the bottom of their heart and through their love for thy neighbor. And so this is a faith-based organization, and through our church networks in all these countries, we're able to get the aid to where it needs to be.
Ed Rain has been doing this a long time. Food for the Poor has been doing this for more than 40 years. And it is faith-based. And they do deliver the goods. And they do deliver. When they needed emergency assistance in Ukraine, they were there. After the Turkey earthquake, they were there. They're the group that I give and Fetching Mrs. Hewitt give money to when there's an international response being called upon to deal with people. Because we trust Food for the Poor. We just trust them. And so whether it's $10 or $100 or $300 or $400,000, whatever you want to give. And I would think if you're a depositor who dodged a bullet, you might be in a charitable mood. But maybe you're not. It's an old story. The widow's mite and the person giving psalm, you know, you're not supposed to let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So I don't talk about it much, but I think people need to be generous if they are asking people to be generous. And I encourage all of you, head over to HughHewitt.com and the banner is at the top, or you can call 855-359-4673. From Studio West, Congressman Ro Khanna has been a guest on the program before, Democrat from the 17th Congressional District in California. Ro Khanna represents Silicon Valley, and as such, he's been in the news a lot defending the Blue Bank bailout that we had over the weekend of the Silicon Valley Bank in Silicon Valley, and of course of Signature Bank in New York City. And so I extended him an invitation because I have two minds. I know that a lot of my conservative friends in the banking business and small businesses wanted this to happen because they were afraid of a run of many other banks. And some of my political friends say this never would have happened if it hadn't been a blue bank. Congressman Ro Khanna, welcome. Great to have you. Give us the version of what's been going on in your life for the last 96 hours.
Well, thanks, Hugh, for having me back on. My view is the principle is pretty simple. We want to have community banks, regional banks in this country. I have no sympathy for the people who were the investors in the bank, certainly not for the executives in the bank who clearly mismanaged the situation. I do believe that the people who just had money in the bank lying there, they didn't know that those deposits were at risk. And they should be protected. If we don't do that, the result would have been that we'd have four banks in this country. Everyone from every regional bank, not just in Silicon Valley, but in red and blue states, would be pulling their money and putting it in J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. As it is, people are doing that, and those banks are having a field day. One final point, for people who say, well, this is just because it's a blue bank, Powell, when he was at the Treasury Department in 1991, actually guaranteed all depositors in the Bank of New England under a Republican administration. And the rationale for that is the same as it is for this. Let's protect community and regional banks in this country.
Well, now, if that in fact happens, I will be happy. But the concerns I hear from people, and Senator Cotton was on yesterday, said, look, if it was a Midland, Texas bank, and it was the deposit of oil and gas companies, which are not favored by Team Biden FDIC or Team Biden Treasury or Team Biden Fed Reserve, they would have been allowed to fall apart and the depositors would have been screwed. What do you think about that, Ro Khanna?
I would have protected it. And look, people can look at my record. I've been pretty tough on big oil. I had the executives in front of my committee and said they had been misleading the country on climate from the 1970s on. Some people were critical of me. No one is going to think that I'm a friend of Exxon or Chevron. I proposed a windfall profits tax, which some may agree, some won't agree. But if you ask me today that big oil, Exxon, Chevron were in a bank and some of their profits were in a Midland bank as a depositor, would I protect that Midland bank if that Midland bank was going to have a run? Absolutely, because it'd be the same result. If you don't protect that, you're going to start to have all of the depositors move to the big four banks. And I guess the question is, do you want banks in Texas, in California, in Ohio? I would think that Republicans who believe in federalism wouldn't want the only banks in this country to be in New York City.
Now, Congressman Khanna, I do believe in federalism, but I also believe in one rule of law. And I am concerned, and I know small business people over the weekend who were sweating bullets that the FDIC would not step in if their bank ran into a liquidity crisis. And so they were moving money to the big four. The real deal here is, has the FDIC de facto raised deposit insurance to an unlimited amount?
Well, here's the thing, Hugh, and here are the facts. There's about $10 trillion in this country that falls under the FDIC insurance. That's accounts that have less than $250,000. There's about $8 trillion more that is currently uninsured that does not fall under the under $250,000. My view of that is that if we want to guarantee depositors, which, by the way, we basically end up doing anyway since 1933. If you look at the history, when banks fail, it's very rare that we don't say that depositors are guaranteed. We should increase the bank premium, and that bank premium should fall on the largest account holders in terms of the cost. And that would, in essence, make sure that depositors are protected.
So we are, in essence, where we were with Freddie and Fannie Mac before 2008, an implicit guarantee that the government will bail out every depositor in the country. Is that where we are, Congressman Khanna?
Well, I don't think it's going to come to that, but I certainly think if tomorrow there was a run on a bank in Arkansas or a bank in Texas or in Ohio, I don't see how the government wouldn't say that those deposits are protected. I mean, people would be outraged that you're protecting the deposits in Silicon Valley Bank, but not in a bank in Ohio. So I do think that the president and the Fed and the Treasury made it clear that depositors will be protected. The question is, how do you pay for that? And I think that means you have to raise bank fees, and you have to make sure that that fee is on the larger accounts that are bearing the risk.
Well, if you're going to find another $8 trillion out there, that's a lot of fees, and those will go through to customers, right, in the middle of a recession. Banks can't just absorb that, so that's an indirect tax on companies and depositors. And I think it's a moral hazard, and this is what I really want. You get this. You understand what moral hazard is. Easy loans, great service. Why Silicon Valley loves Silicon Valley Bank. And it's a pretty eye-opening story in the Journal this morning. And then why top Washington officials chose to rescue SVB and Signature depositors, also another eye-opening. How many people called you, Ro Khanna, over the weekend to get you into the game? I imagine your constituents, more than any, were scared to death by what was happening.
Sure. I had on Friday 600 people on the line. But I'll tell you the stories they were telling me. These are 50,000 companies, some of them, by the way, leading in AI and defense tech. People care about the United States being ahead of China. I mean, you wipe those companies out, you're basically losing a lot of the defense technology to China. I mean, some of these are being funded by DIU, by DARPA. These are companies that are developing the cure for cancer. These are companies, by the way, that employ people across the country. There was a payroll company that employs 400,000 Americans. And so, look, if people may not love Silicon Valley venture capitalists, they may not love Silicon Valley, they may think Silicon Valley's made too much money. That wasn't the question. The question was, do you want to make sure that these 50,000 companies that just had money in their bank deposits were going to be able to make payroll and survive? And yes, you're right that the higher premiums would mean higher fees. I mean, is not free. But the question is, do I think most companies, if you're a business person and you say, look, here's the deal, you got to pay a little bit more into insurance to know that your couple million dollars in a bank are going to be protected if there's a bank run, I think people would, the business owners would say yes. And I think those fees need to be explicitly on people with a larger account, not most people who have accounts less than $250,000.
So last question, Congressman. I use Roku because I use Roku and I know how it works. And I don't know if they're friends of yours or they lobbied you. I have no idea. I'm just using them as an example. Rough numbers. Roku had $1.8 billion in liquid assets, $600 million of which were at the Silicon Valley Bank. Now, Roku is run by smart people. They're changing the industry. They're cutting the cord everywhere. So obviously, they're very smart people. But is tech so insular, so absolutely divorced from traditional rules of banking that they ignored having $600 million on deposit in one bank with a $250,000 deposit insurance? I mean, what's wrong with the tech world?
That was malpractice. I can't defend them. I don't know them. They may be an incredibly savvy technology company, but they need someone who's taken accounting 101. I mean, that to have that kind of money and not to have it in a sweep account or in a mutual market account or in bonds and just to have it sitting in a bank account was just financially irresponsible. The one final point here I'll make on the moral hazard is, let me tell you, the people who are the management and the executives at Silicon Valley Bank, their careers are ruined, as they should be. They're facing investigations by the SEC, by the Department of Justice. They're probably never going to get another job again. I don't think there's any bank management in this country, in any place, that wants to go through what's happening to Silicon Valley Bank. So I do think there's a lot of consequence for being poorly run. And the largest blame, I know there's a lot of back and forth, Republican, Democrat, the largest blame and anger should be at the bank management.
Well, what I want to see is one rule for everyone, because when Enron fell apart, it was an anchor around George W. Bush's neck wrongly. I don't know if there should be an anchor around Joe Biden's neck, but I do want one rule. We got 30 seconds, Congressman. If tomorrow a bank runs into a liquidity crisis, do you expect the United States to back it up?
I don't think it will because of the Fed discount rate. I mean, the Fed has basically said if you have a liquidity crisis, you can borrow in a discount window through the Fed. That, I think, is going to backstop it.
Ro Khanna, good to talk to you again, Congressman. Thank you. Not an easy job to be out defending SVB, but you're making the best case that can be made. I appreciate it.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.